Fire Protection District meeting to order on September 15th, last month of the year. And all the members are here and accounted for. And we're going to move on to the adoption of consent items 3, 4, 5, and 6. Is there a motion?
I move we adopt consent items 3, 4, 5, and 6.
I'll second.
Okay, great. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. Carries. Oral communications, that's the place on the agenda for comments and inquiries, either citizens or boards that are not, on matters not on the agenda. We can always count on you.
Ciara Wood, I wanted to thank the board, Lance, that at our November 12th end of fire season proclaimed by the Elves, of course, we had the fire board turnout, the community turnout. We had, it was very much, I think, a very successful event with the supervisor of the Wildcat Canyon Park, the East Bay Regional Parks, and about 35 or 40 members of the community. I emailed all of you today, and I really appreciate so much your showing up, because you get a chance to see how much that community is supportive of fuel reduction and defensible space. I emailed all of you today a breakdown of the demographics of the Elves fundraising for this year. And it starts out with quite a number of contributions coming out of Berkeley, contributions out of El Cerrito, and then street by street with addresses out of Kensington.
And they reduce as you come down. Everybody on Lake.
Well, many, that is true.
Yeah.
But the other good news that I have to share with you is that as of this moment, our fundraising is now up to $12,637, and it is possible that it will go higher. I'm waiting for some contributions that I expect to come in.
Okay, thank you.
Very good.
Fantastic. Any other comments? Okay. I'm going to rearrange things a little bit here and put the reports, Chief and President's report back. And go on to new business. And we have a presentation on the geotech study that's been going on for some months. And I'm going to simply introduce, I have to get the name straight.
Kevin Ryan.
Kevin, we've met, yes. Kevin Ryan and
Linda Lang.
Linda Lang, thank you. This actually has been a pretty big team. There's actually one other person that contributed, not here. Yeah, so I'm going to just turn it over to you, and I think there's a lot of people interested in how this is going to go because it's got some significance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dorman. Chief Maples, board members, thanks for having us. We'd like to give us just a really brief talk on the results of our geologic hazard evaluation for the Kensington Fire Station. We were brought in, let me back up for a second. My name is Kevin Ryan, Ryan Geological Consulting. I'm an engineer and geologist who specializes in geologic hazards. And we were brought in to look at the existing fire station. Sure. We were brought in to look at the existing fire station at 217 Arlington Boulevard to see what the expansion potential would be.
Do you have the handout here? This is a smaller thing of what he's showing up here, if you'd like one of those, Jim.
Yeah, it might be a little easier, kind of.
And you can follow along then.
Yeah, we do. It's right behind new business. Right there. That's it, right there.
Sorry. No, that's fine. Thank you. That's fine. We jumped right at full speed. The meeting just started. Okay, so one thing that we have to look at when we're looking at development or expansion is the property that the existing fire station is in is within what's called the Elkins Creole Special Study Zone. It's a state-designated zone that goes along the Hayward Fault. And this map here is the state-designated map. The yellow highlighted area that's shown is the state-designated fault zone. Okay, and what that fault zone means is any development, any expansion, any building that's intended for human occupancy has to go through a full fault investigation. So what we've done, or let me back up for a second. On this map, here's the fire station right in the middle of the AP zone, and the state shows three faults in close proximity to the fire station. More recent work studying fault activity through this area by the USGS has identified two potential faults near the fire station. The main trace of the Hayward Fault is located just downslope. Right through here is this dashed line for the existing fire stations here. So that would be on the downslope side of Arlington Boulevard. That's where the majority of deformation has been documented and where everybody thinks the main trace of the fault is. This map also has a question dashed fault that comes kind of near the back of the property of the existing fire station. So we've got two maps here that are showing us that there's most likely more than one fault trace in the vicinity of the 217 Arlington site.
Is there a significant difference between the dash and the solid line?
A solid line has a little bit more confidence of the location. A dashed line is more approximate, if that makes sense. Okay. And then when they add question marks, it's a little more questionable of where that really is. So when we looked at the existing property, 217 Arlington, we were constrained with trying to look at the fault with trenching by some property boundaries. And this exhibit here was pulled out of the geophysical report that we brought in as a third party to help us look underground and beyond the property boundaries at the site. So the fire station property is here in the black box, and the geophysical lines extended from Amherst Street through one of the residential properties, and then down through the parking lot and across Arlington Boulevard, or Arlington Avenue, excuse me. The geophysical study is kind of an indirect method where they're putting in geophones and putting energy into the ground and measuring the response time.
Sorry.
Oh, that's fine. Come on in. We're measuring the travel time of the energy as it hits the geologic materials and then bounces back. So the velocity of those materials has a lot to do with the density of those materials. So what the geophysicists found, so if we look at these three lines going, if we imagine it's an uphill downhill, you have one line coming all the way across the slope up above the property, across the parking lot, and then down through Arlington. This map is also out of the geophysical report, and it has those three lines plotted on it. This is the uphill line, this is the line that goes through the parking lot, and this is the one that runs down the driveway and across Arlington. I think it's pretty clear what we found was there's some dark blue stuff on the uphill sides, indicating fresh, unweathered, fairly hard and competent bedrock, and there's some weathered, different type of bedrock as we get into the property. Now, when we look at something like this, we call this a discontinuity. We've got two different geologic units next to each other. A couple options. One of them is a fault. We know that there's faults mapped in the area. So without physically seeing what this contact is and what this transition is, we have to assume it's a fault. Okay, so we looked into how could we look at this to rule it out if it was a fault or if it was not a fault. There's a 13-foot high retaining wall between the fire station property and the uphill property. Okay, so if we were to have to investigate this feature here, we would have to support the hillside for the upslope neighbor, remove that retaining wall, dig a big trench, replace the retaining wall, and compact everything and make sure that nothing happened to the property upslope. So what we've done is said, well, that's not really a practical method, so we have to assume that this is a fault. So what does that mean for the fire station? Well, what that means is the most likely scenario is there's a fault right at the back wall of the fire station. The building code and the Elk Cliff Pre-Owned.
The back wall of the fire station or
the
property?
I'm sorry, the back retaining wall of the fire station property. Thanks for clarifying that for me. There's a big difference there.
Yeah.
So what the building code and the AP Act mean, or says in the situation is, okay, you have an active fault, you have to have some kind of setback for these buildings. So to expand the existing fire station, we would be expanding into an area that's getting closer to something that we think is a fault that we need to set back from. So it's extremely limited in the expansion potential towards the east, towards the uphill side. We just cannot get around the fact that we need some kind of fault setback. Okay? And the downhill side of the property, we think the faults are sorted out. We think we can get an adequate setback. But there really isn't the potential to demolish the building, rebuild it into a bigger footprint, or expand it in the eastward direction without thoroughly disproving that we don't have an active fault here and that we have a safe situation for a critical facility. Okay, in an earthquake, the building code demands that this building is designed to stand up. Okay, so a critical facility, it has to be functional after an earthquake. And if we put this thing over an active fault, it's not.
What's the setback that the AP law requires?
It's up to the evaluation. Okay, so setbacks in these situations are based on two things. One is, what's the character of the fault? Mm-hmm. You need to look at it to see. And what's the associated area of surface deformation that could happen in any one event along that fault? Mm-hmm. So typically people use a setback of 50 feet. When we're constrained by property boundaries, a lot of times we've been able to go to something more like 25 feet. But we have to go through a very rigorous study to prove, okay, 25 feet outside of the potential surface deformation, mm-hmm. not just the surface rupture. So if we wanted to prescribe a setback to expand, I need to figure out what this transition is, and we need to prove that this area behind the building does not have a potential for additional deformation. Mm-hmm.
Could you just describe what a seismic line is? I'm a little confused by that. It's not a fault line.
Right. No. Yeah. Okay. So the fault line is where the fault moves in the ground. That's a geologic feature. Okay. The seismic line is a geophysical survey. So what they did was they came out with a big long string. They're not strings. It's a cable that has geophones attached to it, and they're spaced every 10 feet. And they go to the end of the line, and they put a plate on the ground and hit that plate with a hammer. A big sludge hammer that uh-huh. puts energy into the ground. So the geophones that are positioned at the ground surface every 10 feet pick up that return wave as the energy goes and hits those different units. So in this case, it was picking up three different layers based on the return times of the velocities.
And how did they decide to put those lines where they are? The
survey lines or
the
or,
seismic
or
the, lines.
These contact lines.
No, the seismic lines.
Okay. So when we're trying to evaluate the fault, we try to investigate perpendicular. So if you have a fault coming through in this orientation, we try to get our data coming across. That way we get the best information. So we were pretty constrained by all the existing buildings. Brenda was able to get access to this property here, where the homeowner actually allowed the geophysicists to go in their yard and run out this cable, run the strings. And then once we got to the top of the retaining wall, he had to come into the parking lot, cut across towards the driveway, and then come down the driveway across. So the position was kind of based on where we could get the most data.
So you drew the lines, basically.
The geophysicists and Linda and I.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Got together and said, okay, this is where we can get it. So, yeah, it was a team effort. And it was based on access.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. So then these layers are based on those differing return times.
Understood.
Yeah. So pretty clearly we found a discontinuity in the geology that's very likely an active fault.
But all of this is supported by existing data.
It all matches up pretty
right.
well. You know, I mean, we feel pretty confident saying the most prudent approach at this point is to call it a fault, because there's also the seismic safety element for the Tri-Cities that has three faults there. There's 10 maps that have multiple faults at that location. So, it's not such a coincidence.
Exactly. Or something that you just
discovered
right now. It's something that's been there.
High level of probability.
It really matches a lot of existing data. And this stretch of the Hayward Fault through Berkeley, Kensington, El Cerrito, Richmond has been very heavily studied. It's active, it's creeping, there's a lot of information of where it is and what these changes are.
So you only verified that?
How far back?
Yeah, I think we did.
How far back is the existing building from that retaining wall, just to give me an
idea? I want to say it's 35 to 40 feet.
Okay. So we really couldn't even, it sounds like it's not feasible to execute the drawings that we have now?
No. Going all the way to the property boundary?
Yeah.
Not from
and
a
geologic
hazard standpoint. From a geologic hazard standpoint, according to the building code, we have to have a setback.
Yeah.
We have to set back from that feature.
Unless much as we are now.
Right. Unless we prove it's not a fault.
Yeah.
But there's
proving a negative is always very difficult anyway.
If we're out in the middle of Napa, we're doing other studies where it's wide open and you dig a trench, we can cross that feature. This is something different.
Yeah, but not feasible
here. It's not really feasible. It's not practical.
So we would be stuck pretty much with the footprint of what we have now if we wanted to.
You would be pretty close to that footprint, yes. On the east-west
orientation,
right.
Yes.
Maybe we could squeeze a little bit more on the Arlington side, but we do have an active fault out there that's confirmed, so we need to go through that study.
Yeah.
And then I understand Chief Maples needs some room for the trucks.
Yeah. Well, you don't have much of a station without an engine.
Honestly, it's not really a good location for a critical facility.
It's not a good location.
You have it, I understand.
Yeah.
If we were doing a study for a new building and say, hey, we want to put a fire station here,
no one in their right mind would do it,
it wouldn't be a good idea.
I have a problem with how you identify the building. It's not a fire station. It's a public safety.
Okay, we'll call it a critical facility.
We're calling it a fire station because it's the inhabitants.
Official identification. It ought to be identified as what it is because.
Well, what triggers it is three firefighters who live there.
That's fair.
What triggers EAP is three firefighters live there.
Yeah.
The police officers don't.
But that's that's not what it's called.
Okay.
Okay. It's an essential facility. That's probably the term that
that's what we call it.
But you know, there are issues with the police and with the fire. And I don't like to see you just identified as a fire station.
Okay, fine.
I have a question.
With
this picture I'm looking at, what's labeled on here as L3 survey line number 3?
Right.
I thought I had something to say that runs along a retaining wall.
It's hard to see. I highlighted on this one here. This big, bold black line is the retaining wall at the back edge of the parking lot.
Okay, so it doesn't, strictly speaking, follow.
No, they came down the hill to the top of the retaining wall and then dropped to the bottom into the parking lot and came across this one.
On this, what are the depths that we're talking about?
Gosh, okay, so at this end, this is about 35 feet from the top of the red to the bottom of the green. So that would be about 35 feet below Arlington Avenue. On this side, it looks like about 25 feet up at the top here.
The bricks are 10 feet.
Yeah.
Those are 10 feet.
Is the area of concern, is it that blue? Is that what is
the area of concern is the transition between the blue and the green.
So it is the blue, though.
It's the contact between the two.
Okay.
The blue is suggesting that we have a more competent type of bedrock than the green. It's suggesting two different geologic materials. They have different densities, so the seismic waves come back differently.
Does it trouble you at all that you come down to where you take that diagonal and the blue totally disappears?
It troubles me greatly, and that's why
that's the discontinuity.
We're assuming that it's a fault.
Maybe you can explain
what you see what I'm saying. Yeah. You're saying that the area that concerns you is the one up in the top there that has the blue underneath.
No, sir. What concerns me is the transition from right here, this point in space right here, where we have one material upslope and a different material downslope.
Right.
So if I put my hand right here, this is my concern, vertically being a fault.
So
does that make sense?
The concern is not how competent the rock is between the blue or the green. The concern is with the discontinuity.
Yeah.
So for me, since I'm, it means that over time, the two plates have been going different directions.
And that area of concern is basically the retaining wall. That's where the fault line may come from.
It's where the retaining wall is.
Unfortunately, it's where the retaining wall is.
And you don't think that could have anything, your analysis could be influenced by the fact that there was probably a great deal of excavation associated with the construction of the fire, of the safety building.
We're well below that. With the seismic lines. We're well below that with the depth, so no. Yeah. No, that's taken
into
account.
Point out where the wall is so you can get a sense of the scale.
The wall is just this little piece up here. So our data is 15 to 20 feet below the retaining wall. Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, what is the depth of your velocity study?
This side is about 35 feet on the scale. Up here is about 25 feet.
And when you say up there, what's that?
This is the uphill side of the hill. And then this is the downhill side.
Can you explain how your methods differ from coring and why you decided not to use coring?
Well, coring is a vertical penetration. The sample has a diameter of 2.5 inches. And you can core closely spaced every foot for 15 feet and straddle a fault and not see it. So we would rather do trenching. Dig a trench, give you the continuous exposure. Okay, but in this case, we can't trench through the retaining wall and we can't trench upslope of the retaining wall. We talked about drilling on both sides and seeing, well, what's that difference? And we're gonna come back and say, you have two different rock types here. We still haven't answered the question of what is that discontinuity, and we still haven't ruled it out as being a fault.
Then what would be hard evidence of a fault?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand what you mean. I mean, to be 100% certain if it's a fault or not, we have to put our eyes on it. We have to physically see what it is. Okay. When the faults move, they create a shear zone, they create a clay layer, and there's a zone that gets chewed up. So you have to see that zone in a trench. It's hard to see in a boring. This is an indirect method, granted, and that's why what I'm saying is for this property, we have to assume that there's a fault here, because we have a very big difference in the geology that we can't explain without assuming it's a fault.
But it also is in the proximity of a fault.
There, all the regional maps suggest there should be one there.
Yeah.
But given that you pretty much, at this point, isolated it to that retaining wall, would it be appropriate to do one or two borings right at the wall?
I would prefer trenching so we could see it. You know, we could. And we had talked about that. If the decision is you have to expand, and there has to be some expansion, whether it's 5 feet, 10 feet, it's not going to be all the way to the property boundary. It's going to be limited. We're going to have to dig the trench to prove that. we're going to have to look at it. We're still going to have to assume there's a fault here if, unless we can get through the wall and into this blue zone to see what that transition is. But even within an expansion, even in a rebuild situation, we're going to have to prove that this ground is solid.
Okay, I have a question. So we're concerned about the blue, but what about the discontinuity between the materials on the going down to the Arlington?
Okay. We have a lot more information. Okay, so these breaks, yes, are you're showing one line, two lines, three lines. Okay, so the reason we're saying there's a discontinuity here is because these colors don't match across. And these two lines, they really do. And the differences through here and in these locations are some of the excavation that was done for the fire station and some of the exploration trenches that were done from the older 1969 trenches. And so this is an old trench from 69, this is an old trench from 69, and this is one of their test pits. So really what we're looking at is below the soil, we've got this green layer that we believe is probably melange, and then we have this blue layer below the melange that's something harder, and those units have offset somewhere.
Well, can you explain melange?
Melange is a rock type around here. It's that really dark black and gray clay with little rock fragments that looks like it's just been through the blender.
Not yet.
It's in all the gullies and all the little creeks and Any other questions?
So,
prior to doing any work, you would have to come out and do further studies, as I recall.
If the decision was to expand or rebuild the existing fire station, we would still need to come in and do a fault study within the property to show that. Okay, so we're going to have to argue for a reduced setback. We're going to have to say that the ground is competent enough to accommodate this bigger building. This new construction is the way it's called, or the way it's considered in the building code. There's still a potential we're going to dig it open and say, probably need a bigger setback. And you don't get any expansion. So there's still a potential. So we were actually originally retained to dig a trench and go from one side, the high side, to the bottom side, for a little bit bigger zone. Once we started getting into the information, we realized we needed to go beyond the property line because the expansion was supposed to go to the property line. That's when we got into this situation with the geophysics. We saw this change, came up with this problem of potential fault with a very limited expansion potential, regrouped with everybody, let some better decisions be made. So we've gone through this for quite a while. Is that too much?
Any more questions?
What is your next step?
Wait for directions.
Yeah, so I think what we have to do is go back to the, the ad hoc committee and sort of see what our options are and then come back.
I thought that a couple months back you had authorized an additional follow-up study by another firm to double-check the results of what I thought was this study.
We actually hired their firm in September. And then as it evolved, they decided, because of the wanting to cover a broader sort of area, the bottom of that retaining wall has got sort of wings or, footings, but makes it 15 feet or 13 feet, so that's an area you couldn't cover, which coincidentally is just where this discontinuity is. So Leanne had the original contract, she's the prime on it, and then we had a geophysicist do the testing, and then he's an interpreter.
I think you may be referring to the peer review that was
authorized.
Yeah. So there's a third party that the county has sponsored to come in and back check.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. Yeah. So that person is looking at this, and basically they're going to confirm that what you've done is professional.
They look over our shoulder, make sure we've followed the proper steps, haven't overlooked anything, and then we've made the right interpretation.
So we haven't seen a report for them, so it's just mainly just meeting and coming to
their report would be a response to anything we publish.
Right.
At this point, we've just had discussions. We've informally talked about the data. I've let him know where we're at from an interpretation standpoint.
Okay.
And he's on board 100%.
Yes, ma'am?
Yes, so my understanding from previous meetings is that you can't do new construction within that close to a fault, but one can do, what, renovation?
As long as you don't increase the footprint,
I see.
Then I don't get involved. Once you, from a geologic hazard standpoint, once you increase the footprint and you're in this yellow zone, then you're bound by the APM. Okay, if that's knocking it down and rebuilding it, if that's adding on to it.
So basically what we're saying here is that we really can't increase the footprint of this building.
It's very constrained.
Mm-hmm. What about increasing the footprint to the front?
I'm sorry?
Increasing the footprint to the front towards Arlington.
There's some potential there, but again, that's going to be constrained by the presence of Arlington. The need for the fire trucks, I believe.
To turn.
Mm-hmm. And we're still going to have to study it.
Could you increase the bill going north?
I don't think so, but that's more of a building code reason. On the north side, they're already pretty close to the property line, so I don't think building code setbacks would allow you to get any closer. And on this side is the driveway, and I think that's probably the minimum that they're going to want for the police. So I don't, it's a postal stamp site.
No, I get that, but if you were to expand to the house next door, what would be the constraints? Obviously, you'd have to buy that house.
You mean take this house out? And, right. Well, we would have to go through the fault study. Mm-hmm. And the constraint would be the same, because the fault comes across this way, and then the other fault comes across this way. Mm-hmm. So you would have the same constraints. You would just have more ability to work within a constrained area. But still, you're between two faults. It's not really a good idea to...
I have another
question. Yes,
ma'am.
I'm sorry.
What you looked at. Mm-hmm. Did you look just at any physical evidence above the ground of any movement? You know, I mean, retaining walls, typically, like, you see...
Well, that's kind of what this map is. This is the USGS's accumulation of all of us geologists documenting offset curves, broken pipes, fences that are warped. So yes, we hiked around and each one of these little notes defined those features. We looked at aerial photographs. The only thing we haven't done is dug a trench through the parking lot.
So are you gonna dig a trench through the parking lot?
Next step.
I think, you know, like I said, we're waiting for the decision to be made of which direction.
Yeah. So you also explained when we talked to you that sometimes the fault will, you know, it's confined, and then as it gets closer to grade, it kind of
flowers out of the surface.
Flowers, yeah.
So that's where the setback comes in, and where we really need to evaluate the ground to make sure that if you did expand, even to no matter what level, that we're not in that zone of surface deformation.
One more question on the physical. Is it possible also that the difference that you're seeing in the, I mean, you didn't look at the exact rock, but based on your velocity study, that could be caused by something like a historic landslide that's just in that area?
It could also be just a big giant chunk of hard rock within the melange. That's what I've been saying. We kind of have to assume it's a fault because we can't see it. There's mapped evidence and at least a dozen articles that show that there's multiple faults there. So without physically exposing it, and seeing it and seeing what that transition is, my hands are tied.
And the faults were, the other evidence, these other studies were done.
Other, by the regional maps. Yeah, there's.
Are those also done with the same methodology, or are there?
Well, this is, for example, this is the state of California's map. Okay, and they're showing, there's the fire stations, the big red dot. The little black lines are where they suspect faults. The seismic safety element for the Tri-Cities area through here has basically the same three faults. The geologic maps have the same three faults. It's very singular up here until it splits. It becomes a complete mess down towards Berkeley and Hayward. But through here, I just didn't want to overwhelm you guys with, here's another map that shows three faults, here's another map that shows three faults. All the evidence tells me as a professional geologist, we have to assume it's a fault until you can show me otherwise. It's the opposite of the law. It's guilty until proven innocent in this case.
I guess the assumption is that to actually do the necessary excavation to determine that yes, indeed, it is a fault, or no, in fact, it's not a fault, is a fairly expensive proposition because you've got...
Step one would be to mobilize onto the hillside with a giant drill rig to put in piers to support the hillside before you take down the wall. Then you take down the wall and take out the 13-foot wide footing that extends 9 feet into the hill. And then we dig a trench below that. Mm-hmm. And then we compact all that stuff and rebuild the wall and hope that that wall patch holds up the same as the rest of the retaining wall, because at that point we've bought the lot above you. That's the concern.
Yeah.
If we could trench there, we wouldn't be in this meeting. We would have a final report that said, okay, here's the results.
Understood.
This is what we know.
I wanted to clarify in my mind and in everybody's that the next step of determining whether or not it really is a fault is a very expensive step.
Right.
But the probability is high. It is. So it's not...
There's a lot of evidence that suggests it's a very unlikely scenario.
There were a lot of questions. Well, why don't you just figure out if it really is a fault? And the reason is because we don't want to spend the money.
The 13-foot wide chunk of concrete. I would have to take a slab of concrete the size of this out.
Yeah.
Underneath the retaining wall to dig a trench.
And all of this to prove that the existing location is the only and the best location in Kensington to put a firehouse.
We haven't got to that step. We've basically been looking at
one site.
This
site and the development potential to expand here, and what are these conditions? I mean, if there's other locations, this one's not
very good.
Ideal, I mean.
Even if we found not a fault on the back wall, this would not be ideal given what you've got on the other line.
If we found that there was no fault at the back wall, and it was something else like a landslide or just a different piece of bedrock, then your potential on that side is greater. Your risk is greater. Okay, right now we're assuming worst case that it's a fault.
Correct.
Okay, if we prove that it's not, what is that going to cost?
A couple hundred thousand dollars
to stabilize the hill before we dig it open and then rebuild it all. So we're looking at
the test and the test
is
several hundred thousand dollars.
Exactly.
Just to prove the point.
And then we spend $250,000 and come back and say, hey, guess what? Geophysics was right.
Right.
Maps was right.
Was right.
Thanks for letting me do
a
research study that I can publish. You either have to live with what you have, live with an extremely small amount of setback that we still have to prove is acceptable.
Or find another location.
Sorry about that, but...
Yep.
Could you make that map available? Because that wasn't attached to the report.
This is not part of the geophysics report. It was just a handout. You can find this on the state's website.
Okay.
The California Geological Survey under the Seismic Hazards Program look for AP maps, is what they call it. And this is for the Richmond Quadrant.
So I'm assuming these colored charts here were made as a result of the geophone information.
Yes.
A Along one of these survey lines, how many geophones do I picture?
They're every 10 feet. So if there's a 120-foot line, there's 14 geophones.
And then you have some software that takes what they collect and draws it.
The geophones are connected to a cable that goes into a seismograph, and then the geophysicist goes and plays with it and comes up with those plots. Those were generated by the geophysicist.
When you did your study and you found out that at the retaining wall there appears to be a difference in the formation, is there a reason why, since you had approval from the property owner to go onto that property, you didn't do a similar test along the back side of that wall? In fact, I'm looking at your chart here and you're showing SL2 line, and your SL2 line actually extends over the retaining wall and into that property, but it doesn't show any.
This is blown up from an 8.5 by 11.
That's not correct.
It's just a registration from the geophysicist. This upper line stopped at the top of the retaining wall. This interior line, SL3, was entirely within the parking lot. SL2 was from the retaining wall.
So my question is still, having discovered this potential fault line that
okay, I understand what you're saying. Yeah. Because the fault, remember I said earlier, we like to investigate perpendicular to a fault to get the most coverage. If we went right along the line, we might be all on blue or all on green. We could be right parallel with the fault. It doesn't make sense to do it parallel to your structure that you're investigating. We like to cross it because the geophysical surveys measure a distance or measure a change through distance. So we want to see that change.
So you just go in and X that way, you just X it across on the other. Is there a reason why you wouldn't want to do that just to verify?
Well, the access, budget, you get the data after you're done in the field. Okay, so the survey was done when we got the results. Once we got the results, you know, honestly, they're conclusive enough for us to stop investigating until we're told to spend more money.
How old is the retaining wall? Do you have any sense of that?
69. About, yeah.
59 or 69?
69. 60. The drawings are dated 69, so, you know.
So did this withstand Loma Prieta or?
Loma Prieta is too far away. There's a difference between shaking. You can engineer things to withstand shaking. What we're trying to avoid is called surface fault rupture. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear. When a fault ruptures to the surface and the ground breaks, it tears. We have to avoid that feature. So let's say this blue line here is where the ground is tearing apart. That's what we call a fault. Surface fault rupture, we have to set back from that. So if this is where we're going to have this problem, we have to build over here.
So you're saying you can build to address shaking, but ruptures are...
You have to avoid. There's some guys that are publishing new studies of how to build foundations on faults, but... Bunch of hogwash. Sorry.
We'll go with you on that.
They want to put a bunch of marbles underneath and let the house rotate on top of it. Oh. Not for a critical facility. I'm sorry.
You're not for base isolation solutions?
No. For a surface fault rupture, it's avoidance.
You don't get away from it.
Yeah, get away from it. Build it to withstand the shaking, but don't let the foundation tear. That's the hazard.
That's the state one that you built on top of the fault.
Because
of that. Crazy. Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's the hazard. Okay. So that's why even if you wanted to rebuild, you start back at square one with the state, and they consider it new construction. Mm-hmm. So.
Any more? Okay. Thank you.
We can investigate it more to figure out that it's a fault.
Well, we have some hard things to do. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Sorry for the boring science.
No, not at all. Yeah.
thanks for the bad news.
Yeah. I don't hear anybody clapping. That's not.
I'm used to it. I am the bearer of bad news. Yeah. So, anyway, you guys have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Sure, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so we're going to go back and come back in January with the beginning of some, you know, things that we think we ought to be looking at. So that should be an interesting meeting.
Thank you.
We had another item for the green energy.
You want to just go back to the fire chief's report? Go back to the top of the agenda?
We're going
to
do that.
Do we have the speaker here for green energy?
Number 7.
No, we don't, huh?
No, but we still have the fire chief's report in the press.
No, I'm yes.
I was just seeing if they were here.
I just moved it to the back.
It's just a question.
They don't appear to be here, so.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Well, that's going to be a tough act to follow.
Yeah, be cheerful.
Yeah. So let's talk about Toys for Tots and children in need.
That'll make you feel better.
Yeah, something that we can be effective on, and we have historically been effective on, so.
Can I ask, circle back 1 second? Who now is on the building committee?
Right now, it's the chief, Brenda, Nina, and myself.
Okay.
And it's changed a little bit over time.
Right.
Yeah.
So in my chief's report there, you'll see a little write-up with in regards to our Toys for Tots program. If you notice this year, I've mentioned this, and it was in the fire club. We transitioned the program this year and partnered with the Marine Corps. We figured we just had a greater outreach with them. The program's pretty streamlined. It's very easy for the folks that want to do it. And it seems to be moving really well. We have toy barrels and toy boxes throughout the community, at the firehouses, the police departments, and some businesses have requested them, so we placed those also. They're also at the community center in the city of El Cerrito. We had a very effective pancake breakfast this last weekend at the community center. I think they said they got 8 or 10 barrels of toys, so it was a great turnout. So we're really happy about that. I have to give a lot of credit to engineer paramedic Damian Carrion. He's taken the lead on that since Rob Murphy moved on to another organization, and he's doing a great job with it, and he's handled the transition well, so it's been good. Not in the chief's report. I'm sure you guys have watched on the news over the last week and a half, the fires down south. On December 6th, on December 5th, we sent OES 300 to the Creek Fire. And on December 6th, we sent Engine 72 with Strike Team Leader Gibson and Strike Team Leader Casterhon to the Skirball Fire. Both of those fires have been contained and are at 95% containment, and OES 300 and Engine 72 after that point were transferred to the Thomas Fire. And so Engine 72 was cleared today at 10 o'clock from the Thomas Fire and is headed home with Strike Team Leader Gibson and Casterhon, and so they should be home sometime this evening. OES is scheduled still to be on the incident for an extended period of time, and we'll be rotating fresh crews out on Friday. So we have been busy down south. I'd ask you to keep the members of our department in your thoughts and prayers. One other thing that I don't have in my chief's report, but I wanted to pass out. Hopefully all of you have already seen these.
Yes, got one.
These are the mailer that we did for the CERT program recently that went to all the residents. You can pass that around. Hopefully everyone's seen them. Right. Just trying to stretch some community outreach right now to get interest in the CERT program. It's been very effective since the cards come out. We filled the first class already.
Really?
It starts in January.
Good for you.
So, we've always used the website. We use the fire club. We've used the newsletters. We've used everything. We're just looking for another formula to get it out there and get people in. So we're really happy that the first class is already full. And that's all I have for you this evening.
Okay. What I spend my time thinking about is the fire station project, the public safety building thing, so I don't have anything there.
Okay.
So back then to
Kensington
Green.
We're down. Well, they are a no-show. Do we want to talk about that, or what do we want to do about that, Brenda?
Yeah, I think you still need to address it. It's on the agenda.
It's on there, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. All right.
They did say they were coming to make a presentation to you, but what's in the packet, I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
You did a lot of it.
They're having trouble.
Is that the fly fishing? So,
yeah. I thought there were quite a bunch. So the nature of this proposal is that we would be getting energy that's totally sustainable. Is that correct? From sustainable?
Correct. Yes. Contra Costa County is going to Marin Clean Energy in right. the spring. So this is asking the fire district to opt up to 100% renewable energy, which costs a little more.
It's about $50 a month, I think.
Yeah, according to their analysis, the Kensington Green Group, it's like 5% more.
4.6.
Yeah.
So, the dollar amount that it would cost is usage dependent, right? So,
correct.
In other words, it would cost us more than it would cost the police district because we use a lot more electricity, or no?
We know what the electrical costs.
For that building?
For everything. I mean, is our electric bill, I assume, is more than the.
We only have 1 meter, and we split it in half.
Oh, okay.
How do they deliver it? So we're getting this green energy if it's going over PG&E.
Oh, yeah.
And PG&E charges you a delivery fee.
Okay.
I can speak a little bit to it.
Okay, good.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So.
Because the police district has already decided to do this.
In our last meeting that we would accept Marin Clean Energy for this building, because of course we don't administer the contract for the public safety building. So the Board of Supervisors agreed that Contra Costa County would opt in to Marin Clean Energy. So unless you choose as an electric utility subscriber to opt out, you will be opting in. Mm-hmm. It should be occurring in January or maybe a little bit later.
April, this is March
or something. Yeah, maybe a little later. And so everyone in the county will effectively be opt-in to about, is it 50% of your energy will then come from renewable sources?
I couldn't tell from this.
Renewable sources. But Marin Clean Energy has the option that you can pay a bit more and get 85% or up to 100% of your energy coming from renewable sources.
Right.
So we agreed with this building that as a board we felt it was within values that we were hoping to promote environmentalism. And
so did you take 50% or what did you?
You picked the 100% option, correct?
What happened was the Kensington Green Group took a year worth of our invoices for this building, energy invoices from PG&E, and they gave that to Marin Clean Energy, and they gave us a cost estimate increase, which for this particular building works out to be about $5 a month.
Yeah.
So it's not, yeah. So they will do an exact study. I mean, if Kensington Green Group did an analysis, it's probably equivalent to what we had.
I'm going to move to table this item until next month when their representative mm-hmm.
I'd be comfortable
joins us.
With that too.
Since nothing's happening until April 2018 anyway, it's not necessary to make a decision tonight.
Right. Let's second.
I would second that. Yeah.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 And I know I did step out of the room. I apologize for that. But if you look at page 4 of what's included in your packet, just for food for thought until next meeting, you'll see a 12 months cost analysis in there.
Yeah.
And so you'll see the deep green premium charge. It's about a 4.58% increase.
Yeah.
For 100%, I think.
Yeah, for 100%.
Yeah, 100%.
So that's
Okay, then it's tabled.
Yeah, and by the way, they don't call themselves Marin Clean Energy anymore. They just call themselves MCE because they're also servicing Solano County and Sonoma County and now Contra Costa County. So they're no longer, they don't want Marin in the word.
And they, just point of reference, I asked Brenda this when I sat there, I think it's 3 years. El Cerrito's been doing it for 3 years already. Because cities could go out ahead of the county and do it if they want it.
And it's been successful.
Yes, there's been no complaints.
Okay. Moving on to election of the officers, starting with president. Anybody want to
open? Yeah, I'm going to nominate Janice to be president.
Okay. Anybody else running against Janice, or?
Well, that's just my nomination.
Okay. If there are no other contestants, I think it's just a matter of voting. Okay. All in favor of Janice?
We need a second.
Hmm?
I will second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? You're it, Janice. Vice President. Janice, you were vice president before.
Uh-huh. Volunteers?
Yeah, I guess volunteers.
I would be happy, Larry, if you would be willing to do it.
Sure.
And I don't know whether you feel your health permits or not, but if your health permits, I would be delighted if you would be vice president.
Oh, yeah. I think my health will definitely.
Yeah, all right. Okay.
Good choice.
Good choice. I agree with that. So, all in favor?
Second.
Yeah. Do we got a second? No. Thank
I can second it.
Okay.
Why not? I'll second. You vote for yourself.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Larry? Secretary.
I was the secretary, yes. Okay. This the past year. And I think the year before that as well.
Sign checks.
Joe.
I think I'd like to nominate Joe for that position.
Second.
Second.
In favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. There you are, Joe.
That was easy.
It's okay.
That's okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Board reports. Janice, finance?
We'll be having our finance committee meeting the end of January, beginning of February. As you know, at our February meeting, we do our mid-year budget review. So we actually review our budget at least three times a year as a board. In June, when we initially adopt it, again, September, when we formally adopt it, and then in February, when we do our mid-year budget review. We also have the finance committee, which looks at the budget in May of each year. So we actually have four budget meetings a year. So that's coming up, and we'll be happy to report to you in February on where we are on the budget.
Okay. Public safety, I think you got the most up-to-date report on where we are with that. Back to Janice on education.
Hopefully you all got your copies of the fire plug this fall. There's been some discussion on Nextdoor of some people seem to have difficulty receiving the fire plug. We use the same mailing list. Huh?
I've never seen
it. We use the same mailing list as the Outlook, so to the extent that you get the Outlooks, you should be getting the fire plug.
You've never seen?
I've never seen the fire plug.
Do you get the Outlook at your house?
Yeah.
Are you sure? Well, talk to Kevin Padian.
Because he says the same thing.
He says the same thing. I don't know what we do about that. I gather people are inadvertently throwing it out without reading it, and I don't know what we can do about that.
Maybe it's stuck in circulars or something.
Maybe, but not every time.
I don't know. We also have it on our website,
right?
For people who don't, who can't seem to access it at home. I don't know what we can do when we're using the same mailing list as the Outlook.
Did somebody actually check the mailing list to see if Kevin's name is on it?
But they're resident,
huh? No. Maybe we don't have the mailing list. Don't they do the mailing for us?
The mailing house doesn't.
Is it
at the library?
The fire plug? Well, I'm sure one goes to the library.
It gets mailed there.
What the library does with it, but it gets mailed there.
I know that stacks of the Outlook get distributed along the Arlington to the merchants.
They're done by hand, I
think. Would it be possible to just do the same thing with the fire plug?
Maybe that's what we ought to try.
I mean, is that something we could do?
And John Day delivers
By hand, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Could we give him a stack and say?
He charges $30 an issue to do that. And I'm sure that he would probably be good.
But maybe checking with the
We're paying for mailing already, right?
This is in addition to
to what you pay for mailing.
Right.
We only do this four times.
Can we afford $30
to
distribute them around town?
That's a good idea, Joe.
I think it's a good idea.
I think it is, too.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of people have not seen
That's
it.
That seems rather strange, but I.
Yeah,
why don't
odd,
we, why don't we pay
John
Day
to
spread them around town?
Have you heard any similar reports about people say that they don't get the outlet?
No.
There's one fellow on the next door who says he gets neither the Outlook nor Kevin Fitzsimmons, I think, says he doesn't get either one. That maybe he doesn't live in a house. I don't know.
Yeah.
If she has no reported address, then he's not getting it. Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to Contra Costa County Special District.
Yes, the next meeting is would be the third Monday of January, and I'm relying on my cohort and Brian here, Nina, to go to the meeting because I will not be able to attend that meeting.
That's the 14th, eh?
Is that the third Monday?
I think it is.
Yeah.
1-8-14, I think.
January.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Warrant mail would be 1-8-15, right?
So 1-8-15, I'm sorry,
yeah,
correct.
January,
yeah, I can't, yeah, you're right there.
I'm an engineer, I'm sorry.
Okay. Anything else
I'm
about...
I'm just head of the finance committee.
Other than that, no, it's...
Okay. Diablo Fire Safe Council.
Don, if I may point out there, for the California Special Districts Association, our newly appointed board president has been added as part of the member services committee and the professional development committee for California Special Districts. Janice is doing that now at the state level. So I think that's great. I think it's great.
Yeah,
thank you.
It gets our fire district and the community of Kensington out at the state level. So I appreciate that.
Okay. Anything about the fire council or was I sleeping here?
No, the last meeting was fairly subdued. We're basically at this point figuring out what to do without a grant and looking at alternative funding mechanisms because we did not get a grant this year.
Your alternative funding measure may be Sierra.
Well, Sierra is definitely one of the alternative funding, but I don't think she's $1 million.
I think she is.
Well.
Yeah.
Okay, correspondence. There's a lot of correspondence, and there's a, Lance, you got a letter that's been signed by about 100 people here from the...
We get lots of letters after we go out on campaign fires, and so this one from the California Department of Tax and Fee Administration thanking us and directly to our organization, I thought was pretty neat. Looks like they had every employee there sign that.
Yeah.
You know, I say this a lot when our folks are out and about like that. They make it a point to make people feel comfortable and present themselves as very approachable. We got a Shutterfly card from someone up there where they took a picture of one of our engine companies and had it made into a card and sent it to us.
So, how nice!
It's very sad what happens in these situations, but when you see these cards come in, it's a nice part of the job.
I think the letters that we get are definitely. I can't help but just look at this and say, boy, I sure am proud that I'm a firefighter.
That's right.
But it really is nice because Santa Rosa, a Girl Scout, for one, and so from Santa Rosa, so that's, there's
a couple troops.
There's rumor that in most of the elementary schools in the Santa Rosa area, that it's not elementary, junior high, the junior high English teachers are using this as a homework assignment that they have the students write thank you letters and then they grade them to have a draft. Then they get to send us the good.
But that's just a rumor.
You know, this is how you teach letters.
Yeah,
right?
It's getting to be a lost art, so I think it's great.
Are we still keeping that binder of all the nice letters we get from people?
Yeah, she still files all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's nice to have that there.
Well, she also if they're crew specific with people's names, Brent puts them in their personnel file.
Good. That's
and,
great.
And all letters that come in get photocopied and go to all three stations.
That's so, great.
Good.
It's good for the troops to see that.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful for morale. I mean, it's heartwarming for me to read these letters. I'm glad the firefighters themselves get to see them as well.
Okay. Well, with that, have a nice holiday. And
yes. Merry Christmas.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Okay.
Last meeting, Dom.